Hi, my name is Dana Halpin, and I'm 72 years old. Today's date is November 29th, 2023, and we're in Lafayette, Louisiana. My interview partner is Stanley Halpin, and he is my husband of 33 years next week.
My name is Stanley Halpin. I'm 82 years old. Today is November the 29th, 2023. And we're here in Lafayette, Louisiana. And my interviewing partner is my wife, Dana Halpin.
Okay. So today we're here to talk about mostly, Stanley, is your work history, the things that make your life unique and your particular contributions, which we're really proud of. We met in 1984 or so, and you told me at the time that you had just come back home to Lafayette, which is a little town in the South, so that you could help look after your mother, who was widowed and had a stroke and needed you closer by, but that the kind of work you did was going to mean that you would leave town from time to time. And that kind of work turned out to be that you were a lawyer, but the kind of work you did, you told me, was voting rights law, which I didn't know a whole lot about. Do you want to describe how you described it to me back then?
This was in the early 70s, I guess, or middle 70s. And at that time, very few blacks were elected to office of any sorts, local, state, et cetera. And that my work had been in representing black voters who were discriminated against in the way the election districts were set up. In short, racial gerrymandering. And I would file suit in federal court on behalf of these voters in order to have the federal courts revise the districts so that they would be fair.
The way they're drawn.
Yes.
Okay. So it was really surprising to me to hear of somebody from the South, deep South, who decided to go into that line of work. You know, most of the people that I had heard of lawyers doing that were either black lawyers or these people from the Northeast who came in to assist them. How is it that you, growing up in the little town in South Louisiana, saw the world in such a different way that was the kind of work you wanted to go into?
Well, growing up in the 50s, the civil rights movement was beginning to get steamed up. And most of my friends and others were opposed to any kind of desegregation, especially voting. But growing up, maybe my upbringing and so on was a little different My parents, my father especially, was very careful not to be discriminating against blacks or saying anything against blacks. And he was very careful. We never used the N-word in my my home, and my father was careful to kind of shield me from it. I know sometime he'd take me hunting with him, and he'd have one of his hunting partners with him, and I could tell he had a little word with him before I got in the car that would tell him not to use the N-word in front of me. And so that's the way I was generally raised, is very careful. he was also, he had a business that was called Chicago Tailors. And as far as I know, he had never been to Chicago, but he thought it was a catchy word to advertise that his suits, tailor-made suits, were big-time Chicago style. At any rate, his business is really right down the street from where we were recording, about two blocks away on Vermilion and Johnson. And it was sort of the crossroads between the black and white communities. And his business was carefully set up to serve both clientele. Tailor-made suits were the thing in the 50s because there were few big department stores with a range of off-the-rack sizes. Particularly when the cotton crop would come in, blacks from the more rural areas would come in and put their money down on a tailor-made suit, and my father would measure them up. And then when the suit came in, they'd come in with the cotton money and pay for the rest of the suits. The suits were made in New Orleans at a wholesale tailoring company, and would be cut and sewed as per my father's measurements. And then I had to get them from New Orleans to Lafayette. And in those days, the shortest distance between two points in rural Louisiana was the Greyhound bus, which you could ship boxes of whatever. And he would have the suits shipped from New Orleans, and he'd go pick them up at the bus station and then make any, when they came to pick up the suits, he would adjust any measurements that you had to do. And in those days, everything went by Greyhound bus. There was particularly a well-known restaurant in Baton Rouge that would ship their baked ducks anywhere you wanted them on the Greyhound. And this got to be quite the fashion to get your duck from Dides in Baton Rouge over the Greyhound bus. Well, my father learned that he'd always send his suits on the morning bus because people would order their ducks on the afternoon bus so they could pick it up around 5 and bring it home and have a feast. He figured out that if he didn't send it on the morning bus, the suit would liable to become there smelling like roast duck. So anyhow, that was the system. He also had a substantial white trade in tailor-made suits, because it was the only place you could get a tailor-made suit in Lafayette. And a lot of Lafayette big shots, if you want, were not easy to fit. They had put on weight over the years and needed a tailor-made suit. So he would get the business of both black and white in that area. So anyhow, his store was a comfortable place for blacks to come and hang out. It was in, you know, a location of town that wasn't exclusively white. It was very welcoming for them. And so when I would go down and hang out at the store, too, there were various black people. There were various black people hanging out as well, and always treated with great respect by my father and whoever else was in the store. So this was some of my early ideas of what racial relations should be like. The other big influence was Gussie. Gussie was our housekeeper, and she had been with our family for a couple of generations, really. She worked for my mother's mother, my grandmother. And when my mother got married, she came along with them, with my mother, and worked for us. And my mother, after a short time, decided to go back to work as a stenographer. Gussie would stay with me as a young child while my mother worked. Gussie turned out to be a great influence on me and the family. Some of it was the treatment she got by my father and mother. That was very very cordial and even loving. She would spend long hours with me, more hours really than my mother, frequently.
So at what age do you think this began to take shape? Like, did you want to be a lawyer when you were a little boy? Did you want to work for equal justice, or because of these experiences, do you think, or when did you get more focused on?
Well, you know, there was times of segregation that were all over, and Gussie would talk to me, and she'd say, "You know, Sonny, that's what they call me as a young child. It just ain't right, the way black people are treated here." And I soaked it up.
So, like, when you started school, was it already in your mind about becoming a lawyer, or?
No, I don't think, not originally at school. I went to grammar school and high school with the Christian Brothers. It was a Catholic school, and I sort of expected, I think, them to be opposed to segregation. But I didn't really hear much from them about it one way or the other. There must have been a code just to keep your mouth shut. So there was a lot about general principles of everybody having a soul and all that, but they still had segregated schools, segregated churches, everything was segregated, so there was sort of an approval of the social system for the most part.
Kind of hypocrisy underneath all that a little bit.
Yes. But at any rate, by the time I got to college, I went to the local college and stayed at home. It was then first called SLI, and then UL, and then now ULL.
University of Louisiana at Lafayette.
Right.
Yeah.
I sort of didn't know what I wanted to major in. I tried pre-med, but didn't do very well in majors chemistry. So at any rate, I was sort of in pre-law or in political science. And it turns out that the political science department was composed of a bunch of young political scientists who were ABD, all but dissertation, and who were there to support themselves and usually their families while they finished their doctorate. Well, along about this time, the state of Louisiana decided that they needed another course, 1 hour course in political science in all of the political science courses, departments. And they had a book that they required be used in that 1 hour course. And it was called Race and Reason by Carlton Putnam. And the book purported to prove that blacks were biologically inferior. And they were supposed to teach this to all of the, it was actually called Communism and Socialism or something like that, the course. Because the desegregation was associated with communists by the state. But at any rate, well, these young political science professors who had no future at UL anyhow got a hold of this course and really ripped it apart. And
you were one of their students.
And I was one of their students. All of us.
That was a big influence on you.
It was.
So even before you got to law school, you already had it in your mind that maybe you would work in that direction?
There was, yeah, something to do there. And I also had a constitutional law political science course taught by one of these professors, John Morgan. We studied, at that time, the Supreme Court was beginning to turn. And so we studied cases like Brown versus the Board and other racial discrimination cases.
So once you got into law school, was it in your mind already to do some sort of constitutional law-oriented specialization or what?
Yeah, I'd already got interested in constitutional law from that course. And so I figured it. But Tulane Law School wasn't very enlightened yet, by any means.
That's where you were. That's where you were at Tulane.
Yeah. So the law school curriculum was pretty much routine contracts and torts and stuff like that, and one constitutional law course that wasn't particularly good.
So what did you first do when you graduated then?
Graduated from
law school.
From law school.
What kind of law did you do?
Well, when I graduated from law school, I had, there were no blacks in law school. There were two women, and they just kind of dumped me out there. But at that time, the Vietnam War was raging. And I was still fairly young. I think I was 23 when I finished law school. And I would be immediately drafted. So unless I got a exemption for being in school. So I decided that I'd like to be a scholar, and got admitted to a PhD program in political science.
So you didn't work in law immediately.
Went straight to otherwise I'd be in the Army.
Okay.
I probably wouldn't have got shot at. I had a law degree, so they'd put me in JAG, the law section of the Army, and I'd carry a law book.
So it was really just a draft dodge here that you went to graduate school.
Yeah, basically. Okay. Basically, well, it was handy. I'd stay a few years, and I'd get a PhD as opposed to staying a few years in the Army and getting a little experience as a JAG officer.
Mm-hmm.
But at any rate.
So was it in your PhD program that you focused in on the kind of law you wanted to do?
Pretty much, because I got away from Louisiana. I was in Washington, D.C. at George Washington University. And I began to see things with a little different lens, that there was
bigger lens for one thing.
Things that I could do.
Right.
I kind of got tired of trying to write a dissertation and things kind of got old in graduate school. And some of my friends, one particular friend, Donald Juno, who I had been in law school with more or less, and Donald was very active. He'd cut class to go to all the demonstrations and that sort of thing. But at any rate, he got a job with this civil rights organization called Lawyers Constitutional Defense Committee. And the work he was doing sounded very interesting to me. But at any rate, I applied as a staff lawyer for Lawyers Constitutional Defense Committee for a job in New Orleans, where Don had been, and another friend later, Richard Sobel.
What kind of cases did they take, or what did you
they
do?
Were, LCDC was set up originally to defend civil rights workers, Constitutional Defense Committee, and
so that was getting more active, and people were doing that work and getting arrested.
Yeah, that's right. Civil rights movement,
people
were
protesting.
Getting arrested, yeah. Needed to get out of jail. But what LCDC was originally set up to do is they would get volunteer lawyers.
Oh.
Just a note, we have about 10 minutes left to record.
Yeah, we need to get to move on. Okay. So you did LCDC work that defended people who would get arrested in the civil rights movement.
Right, but gradually that organization turned into more of a staff lawyer rather than a volunteer lawyer operation.
And just in the interest of time, like, what was the next step in your kind of work that you did, or when did you start trying cases in voting rights?
Well, after a few years of doing general civil rights work, I turned to doing voting cases, and for pretty much the rest of my career, I did voting cases, and I
meaning
researched
districts and
representing black people in gerrymandering type cases.
Okay. Like how districts were drawn.
Yeah.
And they would divide up the black vote, and you would find those districts and make them apply the law, which, what was it, the law that changed it, the...
Well, the Voting Rights Act of 1965 changed up a lot because it allowed you to do, but I did a lot of them even before the voting rights case. And establish some of the precedents in that area.
What were some of the precedents? What changes did you actually bring about with your work that are still ongoing, or that you think are some of the most important ones? Are there any still ongoing that you set into?
Yeah, I started off with a constitutional case, that would set up a formula for invalidating the change that was being made all over the South to at-large elections. Instead of having districts where blacks would be in a majority in some of the districts, they changed to parish-wide,
where they couldn't elect, have a majority.
And then blacks wouldn't be in a majority. So I established the principle that those were unconstitutional under certain circumstances. And
how did you establish that? How do you establish that?
Well, in a case initially in the Fifth Circuit, and that was eventually that eventually would
make it
be changed. The Voting Rights Act was amended to reflect my decision, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it changed the law.
Yeah, the law.
And that went to the Fifth Circuit.
Right.
Okay.
And part of it eventually to the Supreme Court.
So what was that like for you to be arguing in the Supreme Court?
Well, that was kind of batting in the big league. And the court decided to hear my case. Actually, I had won below, and I was afraid they were going to reverse it. But at any rate, it was a frightening experience. I remember sitting on the steps of the Supreme Court waiting to go in and argue, and it was frightening. I thought of it as like Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane saying, "Father, let me pass up from this." And he wouldn't do it.
Stuck with having
so
to be
anyhow,
crucified.
So we're like sweating blood out there waiting. So anyhow, but once I stood up to argue, all that disappeared, and I was able to make my arguments.
So some of your work is still benefiting people today. Some of the changes that you managed to.
Yeah, they were.
Okay.
Some of those are still on the books.
Do you have, since we have such a little amount of time left, do you have any favorite interesting stories or cases that you wanted to share, briefly?
Well, there are a bunch of them, but I'm afraid there's no brief way of describing them.
Okay.
But, there were some involved where I was removing the Confederate flag from school districts, which was notable.
Mm-hmm.
There were cases where black teachers were being fired en masse. I think there were 29 fired at one time, and I got them reinstated. And then there were the voting cases. I mean, I did the Louisiana legislature. I did the New Mexico legislature. I sued all of the parishes in Louisiana, mm-hmm. known as counties otherwise. All of the school boards, most of the cities.
How many cases do you think you tried all together?
Oh, voting cases, I tried maybe 50 in Louisiana. And I went to New Mexico after doing that and did another 30, 40 mm-hmm. cases. So I had a regular.
It was a lot of work.
A lot of stuff.
Well, and just since we probably only have a minute left, how do you want to be remembered?
Well, if somebody did the right thing.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, Dana.
You're welcome, Stan.